Joe, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm so grateful, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to be honest, right? This maybe says more about me than it does you. You're the first third that I've ever met in my life.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, listen, when I was still a member of Congress, there'd be some of my colleagues that would just kind of pick a name of, call me Jack, Robert, Bobby, or Joe. And you're like, it's a Kennedy. It's got to be probably one of those names. So I don't normally, until I was, the last couple of years when I was in office and now out of it, I don't normally abide by the, I don't normally go with the Roman numeral 3 doesn't really follow me around very much.
Yeah, it's not your opening conversation when you're sharing pints with someone you've just met.
No, it ends up being trying to specify like which Joe Kennedy we're actually talking about, which, trying to, sometimes there's safety in numbers. So
absolutely.
I also go with Joe works fine, right? I've been called worse and it's only 10 a.m. here in the morning. So,
I mean, our kind of paths cross.
Yeah.
Really, in some really interesting ways. You're taking it on a new role in Northern Ireland, very historic place. And I just would love to kind of kick off with, who was the first Joe? Give us a little bit of a background into you. And I would love to talk about kind of how you got to where you are today. So who's the first Joe? Who's the second Joe? And then we'll get into the third.
So I'm going to blow your mind here. There's actually four of us. Right.
Whoa.
I know, right?
Someone's lying. Whoever's doing those Roman numerals is not accurate.
That's right, right? Those Romans. So the first, I think like many Irish families, we had there's three names and we just kind of rotated them through, right? So there's Patrick Joseph Kennedy, there's Joseph Patrick Kennedy, and we kind of went through back and around a number of different times. And so my great-grandfather was Joseph Patrick Kennedy. Kind of the who married Rose Fitzgerald, right?
Is he the zero or is he the first?
He is the patriarch. Why don't we put him that way?
Gotcha.
So he was kind of that's where these numbers anyway started. So Joseph Patrick Kennedy Sr. He had a son, Joe Jr., who was my grandfather's brother. Robert Kennedy is my grandfather. He was his brother. He was a pilot in the U.S. Navy, and he was killed during World War II. The numerals normally go by kind of descent. So he was Joe Sr. and then Joe Jr. My father, who again was Robert Kennedy's eldest son, was Joe then the second, because in a line of descent, it went from senior, it skipped junior off to the side, but in line of descent, he was number two. And then I was named after my late great uncle who died in the war. And so I became number three. So there's actually four of us, but number three. So it gets a little confusing.
Love it. So, I mean, one of the questions we usually ask people is, what's one of the first things you can remember? If you cast your mind back to early experiences, early memories, what's young Joe up to?
I mean, as I said, we were just chatting before we started about life with young kids. I can't remember what happened this morning, right? anything before 6:30 this morning is a blur. One of my probably earliest memories is playing / roughhousing / fighting with my brother, because that's what twin brothers do, and I got a twin. It was great, obviously, growing up with somebody, because you had from your earliest memories, you had somebody to to get into trouble with and to entertain you and to wrestle over toys with and to run around and cause trouble. So those are definitely earliest memories. When I was, as I think they say in Northern Ireland, a wee lad, involved my brother, Matt.
Nice one. And so, you start to get a little bit older, you go through boyhood. What does Wee Joe look like? What are you into? What are you up to? Where's home for you?
Wee Joe is in around Massachusetts. So born in Boston. Shortly thereafter, my parents moved about 45 minutes south of where we were to a community called Marshfield, which is on the south shore of Boston. We were there for about 5 or 6 years, 6 or 7 years before my father ran for office. He was a member of Congress for about 12 years. We moved back up into Boston. And then I lived in such the city of Boston until I was 18 and went off to college, university in California. I was in California for 4 years. I went off to New York City for about a year working at the United Nations development program, and then off to the Peace Corps in the Dominican Republic, where I was for about 2.5 years. And then I came back after that to law school in Boston, and have more or less been around the kind of Boston area ever since. Bounced around a little bit, but, you know, firmer roots now down here with, I was able to convince a young woman who grew up in California, I met in law school, to stay in Boston, which for those of you who are familiar with the climate of Southern California versus the climate of Boston, not an easy thing to do, but she stuck around, which is great. Lauren and my wife, and we got two little kids, Ellie, who's 7, and James, who's 5, who keep us busy. So that's life in a nutshell.
This episode is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, where we interview an interesting person from Northern Ireland who's living and/or working overseas. Now, who are NI Connections? They are the diaspora department of InvestNI, and their mission is really, really simple. It's to connect the Northern Irish community all around the world. They put together some really incredible resources, including how to move you and your family back home if you have been living overseas, how to move to Northern Ireland for the first time, and even how to move your business or open up a new branch in this wonderful place that we call home. You'll also can find hundreds of interviews and profiles with fascinating people who are proud to call this place home, and you can check out all of these things and sign up for their free email newsletter at niconnections.com. Thanks very much, and I hope you enjoy the rest of today's episode. So whose idea was Peace Corps, and how old were you when you went?
Peace Corps was my idea, oddly enough, after kind of getting a lot of advice from folks. And it was, most folks don't know this, I was actually an engineer. My undergraduate degree was in engineering, a form of industrial engineering. But I was smart enough to know that I really wasn't actually that good at it. looking around at my classmates, folks to my left and right, I'd be like, you know, if I was working at Google or McKinsey or some, you know, place where smart people go, and I had the chance to hire me, I would hire that guy. So, like, I got to figure out a different profession here.
Yeah, it's one thing being able to pass the classes, and another thing being able to have a good go at something.
Yeah, right. Like, as I say, if you look at the resume, it sounds impressive. If you look at the transcript, less so. So I got to keep the transcript closer, right? You know, it was a, I obviously had been, my classmates at that point, you know, I was 21, 22 years old and graduating from school. They were going off into a lot of these consulting firms and business, whatnot, and investment banking. I wasn't ready for a desk job. I didn't want to go spend 20 hours a day and sleep at work. There was a big world out there. I wanted to see it. I wanted to experience it. I wanted to do something that was mine. That like what's going to be experience I could hold on to and have. And I obviously been very fortunate in my life, and I wanted to find a way to make some sort of contribution back to the community. And when you line those priorities, if you will, up, those objectives up, Peace Corps comes up to the top of the list pretty quickly. Interestingly enough, I'd also strongly considered joining the military. And my family has a history in the U.S. Navy. I took a test to go to flight school in the Navy, it was a 2-year wait to get into flight school. Interestingly enough, as I learned from talking to a naval recruiter, since the first Top Gun came out, they have never had to advertise for naval aviators.
Yeah, it's so strange as well.
Who knew?
It just boggles the mind.
Right, that's everybody, right? You find an 18-year-old kid, you're like,
is that when they brought out a second movie? The applications right. Finally started to dip. They're like, we got to get another one of these things out here.
And you know what? They solved that problem too, right? so they, I guess I was part of their talking audience, and I fell victim for that too. But it was an 11-year commitment at that point, because it was a 2-year waiting period, and then a 9-year. Commitment, because after they train you, they need you to stick around. And I was 21 or 22 at the time, and huge amount of respect, obviously, for anybody that is able to make that commitment. That was half of my life at that point, right? I was 22, and it was an 11-year commitment, and I wasn't quite, as I was trying to think that through, I could go off to the Peace Corps. That was a 2.5-year commitment, a little over 2-year commitment, and then still have 9 more years to kind of do stuff that was...
Yeah, see what happens. You're not locked in.
I ended up in the Dominican Republic and loved it. It was by far the most impactful professional experience I've ever had. I can't say that I loved every second of it, because, you know, you're way outside. I was in a country I'd never been to, in a language that I spoke, you know, my Spanish was functional when I got there. It obviously got pretty good by the time I left. But country I'd never been to, community I didn't know, language I didn't really speak. Intermittent electricity at best, intermittent running water at best. You know, way outside of comfort zone as to kind of what I'd come to know and expect, which is what I, on the one hand, which wanted, and I wanted to understand and to have that experience. You know, it is a different way of life. And we were talking a little bit earlier, you know, on the one hand, your horizons do shrink, right? Like my classmates at that point might have been working for Goldman Sachs or McKinsey and are flying all over the world and going to a lunch meeting in New York and a business meeting in Boston and some other place in, you know, London or Belfast or wherever. And my horizon was 100 yards in each direction, right? This tiny little community in the outskirts of about 45 minutes away from the south coast of the Dominican Republic. But it was an incredible experience for me, and to see how a community that, again, I didn't know, just adopted me and treated me like family. And one of those lessons that you just hold on to where across these huge differences of culture and divide and language, there are just, you know, there are human traits and there's humanity. I've had the good fortune to travel to a lot of countries around the world, dozens and dozens of them. I have yet to go to a place where if you take a ball and throw it at a child, they don't pick it up and throw it back, right? And there's a connective thread that when you are able to put yourself in a spot that is so different and you see those responses that you can still understand, right? The look, the glance, the laugh, the smile, the play, right? Kids are kids and kids are going to play wherever they are in the world. And that connection was something that it's incredibly valuable to me.
It's really interesting. You know, it's really interesting that you really wanted to join the military or do Peace Corps. There was that desire to do something. Yeah. And I think so many young people, and particularly so many young men, can really relate to that. I had an experience where I ended up in Rwanda at 18. And again, it was just that same sort of force, I think, or pull maybe is a better word. I kind of felt drawn to go somewhere and do something. That idea of wanting to do something for yourself, wanted to do something that was your own. Talk to me more about that.
You know, it was, I have been from a very, very fortunate family. And with that privilege comes an awful lot of opportunity. I also know that I had seen enough from my other family members in public life to know that, there will be some that project on you successes and characteristics that you have not come close to earning or necessarily deserve, right? Or aspirations that they would project on you that they would hope you to try to live up to, which are infeasible at best. There are others that will also try to tear you down just for the nature of being, you know, who you are, a part of family that I'm from, and there's nothing you can do about that, right? There's people that will, I would meet on the side of the street and say, gosh, I hope you're president of the United States one day. You're like, why? Like, you don't know anything about me. Like, I'm walking the dog. I mean, people walk a dog, like, that's it. Like, you, I appreciate that. And
no, but Joe, the way you walk the dog, oh my God. Like, I've seen you walk a dog, man, and the way you walk it, it is presidential.
That is leadership, right? I mean, it's just like crazy. It comes from the nicest of places, the nicest of sentiments.
Sure.
And so, like, grateful for that sentiment, but, like, you actually don't mean what you say because you can't actually mean what you say. And so having an experience that wasn't going to be able to be labeled, right? Oh, you just got this because of your family. Or nice. Whatever job I got, somebody really cool. is going to be able to say, you got because of your family. And to some extent, like, of course, right? Like, of course, that, you know, my name is Joe Kennedy III, right? Is it safe to assume that at some point, somewhere along the line, somebody would make the connection and, you know, my family, whatever, would have some influence in it? Yeah, I'm sure it does. And so there's nothing you can do about that. Trying to say it was all on because of your own merit is also not wholly honest, right? It just can't be. But being able to have an experience that other people aren't actually going to know about, that they can't take away from the relationships that I was able to build with the members of that community. They don't know what it was like. And I wasn't doing it for them. I was doing it for me. That was an incredibly important anchor for me to just to be able to say, okay, this is what I did. This is where I succeeded. This is where I failed. These are the lessons I take from it. This is what I will, you know, I was 22 years old, right? 23 years old, 24 years old. You're not going to get everything right. You're going to screw stuff up, but they're incredibly important lessons to be able to have at some point in life that centered me in a way in which I don't think other experiences would have.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, public service is really, really important to you. It's really important to your immediate family. It's really important to your extended family. Was there any ever kind of moment as a young man where you're just kind of like, I want to just shirk all of this and just go and do something else totally different away from all of this stuff?
Totally different, maybe. I mean, I think to some extent, members of my family have been bit by a bit of that public service bug because, going back to that woman when you were walking the dog, not to say that, hey, because people project on you that you should go then necessarily run for office or do these things, right? But it is to say that you do get to see that service matters to people and that the service can have an impact on people and that you can, if you are dedicated enough and patient enough and thick-skinned enough, which is hard, willing, that you can, in fact, make a contribution to try to soften the rough edges of this world for folks that need it and deserve it. And that's that is one of the true blessings that I've had as being a member of my family, is that you do hear people tell you stories of how the work of my various relatives, or to some much smaller extent, some of the work that I had done and others, how it had an impact on them and how it helped them, right? Whether it was, walking down the street to Boston and have a family say, hey, your dad and his nonprofit energy company where I do some work now, Citizens Energy, he helped heat my home in winter, right? Or the impact that my uncle, Senator Kennedy, had on somebody, whether they were immigrating from, you know, abroad or struggling with access to healthcare or a veteran struggling with veterans benefits, you just hear those stories and you see the impact that it can have on people. You understand that. And if you are in a position to be able to make an impact for people, that I think there's an encouragement in my family to try to take it, right? And to do the best that you can for folks that need it. Now, I think what has evolved with time is a broader understanding and definition as to what that can be, right? It doesn't mean you have to go run for office, right? You can do that through, the practice of medicine. You can do that by being a school teacher. You can do that by, my Aunt Lori is a celebrated documented filmmaker, right? My cousins founded Best Buddies and Special Olympics, founded by my Aunt Eunice, right? Like there's an widespread number of ways in which you can try to channel your efforts and energies and talents and what have you to try to make a positive difference in the world. And the extent to which there's an encouragement by kind of that momentum, I think that's certainly there.
You know, I was sharing with you before we started recording, we just had our second girl, our second born child, 4 weeks old. We were talking about your kids. You've got two young kids. And I was wondering, like, in your childhood or your boyhood, was there ever a conversation or ever like a sit down where your father or someone else in your family explained what had happened to your uncle, to JFK and Bobby? Because that the scale and the extent of that ripple on the world, and never mind your own family, is so big. I'd love to know, like, how was that dealt with internally? Like, because you obviously, you must learn about it pretty early on in America. Like, I remember the first time. So I went to high school, and in first year in history, we do Titanic. And then I think we did JFK and that period of America. So we even got it pretty early on. I can't imagine how quickly you would have got it.
So, you know, it's interesting. I don't have a firm recollection of, you know, a sit down and a conversation. My great uncle, President Kennedy's passing was, you know, well before I was born. I was born in 1980. So, 17 years beforehand, my grandfather 12 years before. So there was, some passage of time. And by the time you're kind of old enough to understand what that is, you absorb more of it just from, culture, mass media, et cetera. And a long time to kind of understand what actually happened and what that meant. The part, Matt, that I it's not to say you remind people from, but that often gets lost in that, right, is without question, these are significant historical events, right? And they're written down as some of the seminal moments of American history of the 20th century, right? And these pivot points, particularly politically. American society, it had a huge impact across those events, had an impact across them in a variety of ways that again, to some extent, we still wrestle with today. The part that often gets lost in that, right, is the, again, back to that humanity, right? It's, the America lost a president.
Yeah.
A young woman lost a husband, and two little kids lost a dad. And there's a very deeply personal impact with that, which, by the way, plenty of other folks can sympathize with, right? There's, they're not the only ones that have had to endure that tragedy, right? My dad's brothers and sisters, right? My grandmother had, at that point, 10 children and was pregnant with number 11, right? And, the impact of that is literally multi-generational trauma is still a very real thing. Someone doesn't talk about it very often, but it does. They have mentioned it from time to time. And, I think it is something that... that if people think about for a second, it kind of clicks. But when you're talking about the kind of historic notion of or nature of these events, that's not the part that they think about first. It's, it's the event, not the personal ramification. I think it's also what... it is also what I think continues to draw on my family's resonance or the issues that resonate with my family of Ireland, Northern Ireland, because tragically, we are not the only family that calls this island, as a part of their past or present that has had a similar experience, right? And so there's an understanding that of what that loss actually means on a personal level. And of the work that needs to be done to try to, you can never move beyond it, right? But to move through it, right? And to make sure that successive generations aren't held back by it.
So you mentioned Northern Ireland. Honest answers only, okay? Like, when was the first time that you actually even came across Northern Ireland, heard of Northern Ireland? What was your early impressions of it?
Oh, God.
I lived in the States for 3 years. I lived various places around the world. And there seemed to be, if anyone knew about it, it was not the golf courses at that stage.
Similarly, gosh, I can't remember the first time I would have heard about Ireland or Northern Ireland. I mean, it was just like, that's kind of along the lines of, when did you know about your parents or your siblings, right? It's just, it was around, right? Always. And because of, longstanding engagement, family has a proud history, obviously, in Republic of Ireland, but also Northern Ireland as well. And working on these issues, my aunt, Gene Kennedy Smith was ambassador to Ireland and played a significant role in the lead up to Belfast Good Friday agreement. And so, you know, these issues around Ireland, Northern Ireland, were just, these were things that were talked about when I was younger and a kid. And one of the benefits of a big family, at some point, somebody is always passing through one way or the other. They're over there all the time, right? And so it was a, it was just part of, it was part of life. And yes, the when I was a kid and then, you know, Good Friday, obviously 98, I was 18 years old. And so 17 on Good Friday, but you know, so you kind of through a lot of this, you know, starting to become more aware of the world around me by the time you were, you know, 10, 11, 12, 14, 15, right? My father was in office for those years, so he was very involved in a number of these, in the issues and the run-up to Good Friday. My uncle certainly, so like, it was something that was tangible. It wasn't something that was foreign. You know, but yes, more focus on some of the geopolitical challenges of the moment than the golf courses.
And so you're making your way through your career, doing all sorts of really, really interesting things. You know, you've done the House of Representatives, you've done the energy stuff, like this amazing, amazing career. Like, how does this role that you're in now even start to remotely come onto your radar? I understand we're skipping huge portions of your life here, you know, decades of your life, but we'll do so very smoothly. we'll pretend it's smooth anyway. That's how it usually works. And so, you know, what even is this role, Special Envoy to Northern Ireland for Economic Affairs? If you were to pretend that you were speaking to someone who knows nothing about the US political system and hypothetically has no idea of any of the structures or how any of that works, how would you explain what that role is and what your kind of aim is?
So, look, my role is quite simply to try to support the future economic development and prosperity of the people of North Ireland, right? Period and full stop. And what I think that then comes down to is to say, you know, the politics in a lot of places at the moment are complicated, U.S. as much as it is anywhere else. And so you can, if you start out any of these roles by getting kind of defined by the politics, you can find allies, but you will create adversaries. Whereas if you focus on some of these fundamentals of like, do you, you know, John Q. Public, Joe Kennedy, Matt, want a good school for your kids, a job that keeps a roof over your head, a food on your plate, and a safe and secure retirement? You want clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, and a safe community. I don't care what your political persuasion is. The answer to those questions is yes.
Right.
Yeah. And so now how you get there and the choices that are made to get there might differ. And there's legitimately good reasons for that. And so you can't put the politics wholly aside, but you can start from a baseline level of achievement to say, okay, well, if that's what we're going to, we were moving towards, there's pieces on this that all of us agree are going to need further investment, need further development, need further activity. So more jobs is a benefit. So the president said, go do a trade delegation. So we'll go do that. Great. Jobs, from my perspective, are a means to an end, right? Hopefully you find that work to be meaningful and fulfilling. And hopefully you do. But it also has to be able to keep that roof over your head and food on the plate and your kid in a good school. Because if not, you've got a problem. Right? So means to an end. But just because you have a good job doesn't mean those ends will be met, right? We have seen undeniably Northern Ireland has achieved an enormous peace dividend. Period, full stop, that is true, right? It is the safest city of its size in the UK. It is the largest destination for cybersecurity investment in all of Europe. If you've got a college degree, the equivalent thereof, your unemployment rate is essentially zero, right? It's the happiest region of the entire United Kingdom. These are enormous achievements that most people do not know. So huge credit.
Me included. I'm sitting here and I'm like, wow, that's class.
It's good stuff, right? It's good stuff. And you should be very proud of that. And there has been a piece, Belfast Good Friday Agreement helped create the opportunity for that to happen. That being said, are there still challenges across Northern Ireland? Yes, absolutely there are. And so part of the job here is to try to expand, to widen that peace dividend across communities that haven't fully received that benefit. That means more involvement economically by more people. That means a greater acquisition of skills. That means apprenticeship programs. That means entrepreneurship. That means, you know, getting women more involved in our economies. That means childcare, making childcare more accessible and affordable, because you want to get more, you know, one, it's super expensive no matter who you are. It's an economic issue now all over the kind of industrialized world. But as you know, and you're about to find out yet again, good childcare is, one, super expensive and worth every penny. But if you want to get young parents back to work more quickly, you got to make sure their kids are cared for appropriately. And if you've got an economy that is desperate for skills, you need people with skills to get back into it. So how do you provide that? Well, then also attracting more talent that might have otherwise, Matt, your generation, gone to London or Edinburgh or Dublin. You want to bring them back. If you can afford a place to, you know, to buy a house, and you can afford good access to childcare and a high quality of life, that's harder to do in London at the moment.
Yep.
And so there becomes an enormous competitive advantage to actually looking at childcare not as a kind of task to be fulfilled for the education of the child, but as a way of saying, hey, how do we turn this into an economic, how do we address this as an economic issue for a family? How do we look at this as a workforce issue to get people back to a workforce more quickly? How do we look at this as an attractiveness issue to bring young talent back to Belfast and Northern Ireland? And how do we look at this as a space to actually create the intermingling that Northern Ireland desperately needs, right? Where, as I was saying earlier, two-year-old, three-year-old, you're on a swing set, playground, whatever else. I've never heard a two-year-old or three-year-old ask what tradition you believe in or what.
Yeah. Is this swing a Catholic swing or is it a Protestant swing? Because I'm not sure. I just don't know. It's painted a neutral color and it's really throwing me off, man.
And it goes back and forth. Who knew, right? Who knew? There is, and as you also know, and perhaps as I found out, when your kid is having a temper tantrum and throwing Cheerios down a hallway in a supermarket, happens to the best of us, regardless as to whether you happen to be Catholic or Protestant or something else.
Yeah,
because parenting young children is a journey no matter who the heck you are. But there's a camaraderie that comes to that. There's an empathy that comes with that because we've all been there. And so there's a way here to think of this strategically as a huge strategic asset for Northern Ireland, but also as a way to attract talent, to create the space, to bring people together, to share those experiences, and to provide the space and the opportunity that otherwise might not be there or might be harder to create or harder to find. And so I look at this as a focus very much on the economics of spreading that prosperity, but then on diving pretty deeply and strategically into those areas that can have a catalytic effect across Northern Ireland society.
Cool. I have one more question on this and then we'll start to land the plane and kind of one or two questions to kind of finish. Really simply, like, what is it? What can you do? So you've been given this job. President Biden phones you up. He's like, you know, you've got this thing. What tools are put in your hands? Like, what can you do? Is it a case of, okay, your job is to go in there and be like a super connector, and you can, you know, make all these bridges between whether it's business people or otherwise. Do you have access to money? You know, what is it that, what tools do you have in your hand to achieve this goal
so,
that you've talked about?
I think I've got a lot of tools, but I mean this sincerely, it's not just pablum here. The biggest selling point is Northern Ireland, right? Like,
yeah.
So people said, well, you know, is the U.S. government going to bring a whole bunch of money? Northern Ireland doesn't need the U.S. government to bring a whole bunch of money. You're the highest, you get the largest concentration of cybersecurity investment in all of Europe. Without U.S. government money, right? Like,
yeah,
did that. You don't need. You're not. It's not a developing nation, right? Like, you're well on your way. You don't need USAID isn't going to go make a big seismic investment in Northern Ireland because Northern Ireland does not need USAID money. So, like, let's be clear about that. What I do think, Matt, one of the biggest surprises for me, and I hope this comes out the right way, man, is...
brace for impact.
I know, seriously, right? Dangerous words. Let me frame it this way. Good friend of mine lives in London. And we had this conversation a couple years ago, and he said, you know, the phrase I love most about you Americans is, you say, we'll figure it out. And I feel like the confidence of that phrase, like, whatever problem comes up, you're like, I don't know, we'll figure it out. But, like, why do you think you'll figure it out? Why is there, like, there's challenges out there, and you go, I don't know, we'll work it out. Why do you think so? But yet you do. And the confidence, but the embrace of those challenges then to say, none of this is fatal. It is surmountable. If we get the right people to work on it with the right way and with the long enough and hard enough and determined enough, we will find a way through it.
Yeah.
And God, I wish more than anything, Northern Ireland would take a dose of that. You all have done what Northern Ireland has accomplished these past 25 years, from hundreds of years of conflict and division to 25 years of peace, is an extraordinary achievement. Have you solved every problem? No. And if you had, by the way, come to the U.S. We've been working on it for hundreds of years, and we got plenty of them we need to solve. So, like, but just because you haven't solved every problem in these last 25 years doesn't mean that the sky's going to fall tomorrow. Right? Take pride and confidence at what you have achieved, and know that if you've already done the hard part, the next 25 years, are there real challenges? Sure. Are they insurmountable? Hell no. Because look what you
do.
So the biggest thing I think I can bring is a shot of confidence in the arm to say, hey, you know, I've had this conversation with investors, you know, and such in the U.S. and the U.K. and obviously in Belfast, of folks saying, you know, if one of these entrepreneurs came to the United States and were making a pitch to a venture capital firm, they would add a zero to the request because they weren't thinking about it. And like, I don't know, we'll ask for, you know, somebody here asked for $1 million, they'd ask for $15 million in the United States.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
So to have a sense of, we can accomplish this, look at what we have done, the future is attainable and deliverable. And what I hope to do in this is to help reframe a bit of that narrative, to modernize that narrative about Northern Ireland for Americans, for business community and American society, just to say, hey, this is not just a question of golf courses and, you know, historical visits. There is a very strong narrative here that people should get behind for really positive reasons. And then to try to take on and to find, yes, ways to connect, to address, to leverage some of these larger strategic opportunities that I think have presented themselves on issues like skills acquisition and, you know, catalyzing entrepreneurship and childcare, mental health, et cetera, to try to address some of these areas that need to be addressed, that, you know, a vibrant social sector in the United States seeks to do in our communities too, right? And to try to do it that way.
It's great. You've either been incredibly well prepped or you're speaking the truth, right? Because something we say all the time on the show is that the number one thing that we think that Northern Ireland needs, just in terms of the average person walking the dog down the street who doesn't dream about becoming a president, is just a little bit of American confidence. And I don't know what you guys have over there, but you've got it. You know, like it is. And if we could even have a half shot of that, I think you would see some amazing things happen. And the people who do really well, you know, in this building here, Omo Bass, where our studio is, or, you know, through the young entrepreneurs that we work with in Young Enterprise, it's those guys that just have that little bit of, like, American swagger to them that are just killing it. Because the biggest thing that holds us back, speaking from experience, is ourselves, you know, there's just that, go on, go for it. Like, you'll figure it out. Like, don't sweat the small stuff. Like, go.
And so,
definitely resonate with that.
I was with Sarah Fryer this morning in Boston. So,
were you really?
I was.
Class.
Your guys' ears should have been burning, and you know, obviously a remarkable business leader in her own right. But
oh man.
But a great success story of what Northern Ireland can be, will be, should aim for and shoot for.
Yeah. Right?
Of this is what you all can do. And
yeah,
for me, honored to be along for the ride and do what we can.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned we refer to Sarah Fry as the First Lady around here. You invoked the name of the First Lady. I would turn my camera around, but I don't want to mess my angle and my focus up. But we have a Sarah Fryer quote in the studio. She said it in the episode. This is maybe episode 80 or 70 or something bananas like that. I think your episode will be like 330. And it's like become a mantra. And she just said, you know, you can't be what you can't see. And it was on this very topic of female entrepreneurs in Northern Ireland. And she said the importance of showing and celebrating and shouting loudly about the people that do well, because it sets the example for other people to follow behind. And so, yeah, I think that's super cool. Anything?
I'm texting her right now saying that you just quoted her. So there you go.
Yeah, come on. Thank you, Sarah. We love you. If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a cup of coffee, who would you take and why?
Oh, gosh. I think on this one, what I would love to have is the imagination of C.S. Lewis, right? The ability to tell a story the way that mind, the way that he could, the way that that mind can, but just the power of that imagination, right? To be able to understand that inspiration, to have that level of creativity, that gift of words. I would want to do it for longer than a cup of coffee, but I would really look for it.
I'm going to butcher this. All the C.S. Lewis mafia is going to kill me for this, but he's got this great quote about, it's something like, I've never found a cup large enough to satisfy the amount of tea I want to drink. Right. Something along those lines. And so you could go for a mega cup of tea, yes, and just hope that it keeps going, keeps going.
But I mean, man, like what a treat that would be.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't know he's from Belfast. He's Belfast. There's a wee plaque outside the house he was born. He quotes.
I was, as an aside real quick, I was down in Los Angeles last week working on an energy project, and I walk into the Los Angeles Department of Power and Water, LADWP. Maybe you all know this, but I did not know that the founder of LADWP was from, of course, Belfast.
Dude, there is something in like a Notion database in the background here where I remember writing down years ago that like something about the LA Viaduct or something.
So,
I don't understand, so, but yeah.
Mulholland Drive, you heard of that?
Mulholland? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
William Mulholland from Belfast. That's him.
That's what it was.
So, exactly. Like the water that goes into Los Angeles, you can thank a guy from Belfast. Literally. Right? Like, literally, you can thank a guy from Belfast. Google.
So, I'm going to spread just absolute folklore to you right now, okay? But it's been passed to me. Apparently, the guy who designed the American Eagle is also from Northern Ireland. Now, I don't know. Like, I don't know if that's true, but
really?
There's one for you to check
we'll
out
check on
your,
that one.
In your travels.
I will definitely check
the
that
team
one.
To but fact yes, check me on that one.
For folks in Los Angeles, all your listeners in LA, you can thank a guy from Belfast for your water.
Class. Very, very cool. Joe, final question. We've come to the end. The end is nigh. Oh, no, sorry. I had one more thing to say to you. Queen's University has a library. And on the second floor of the library, have you been? You're shaking your head.
The table.
Yeah, the C.S. Lewis room.
Yep, been there.
Very, very cool. Super I was going to offer you my old student pass to get in, but you
super
didn't.
Super cool. I mean, it's part of what I was trying to think about when I was in there thinking about the magic, because they have that table where they've got the drawings and the map and the quotes around the ring and the mm-hmm. ceiling. And just thinking about the imagination that guy had, right? I mean, amazing.
It's phenomenal. Yeah. Great. Final question, Joe. It's a question we ask every single person that we've ever interviewed. And it's very simply, it's a classic. If you could go back in time to an 18-year-old version of yourself, you had a couple of minutes of his time, what sort of things are you saying?
I would say, I would say, I guess, two things, right? And I sound like such an old man on these, but like,
This is your time to be an old man. This is an old man question. Come
on. Thank you. I appreciate the permission.
You should say, save for retirement, stay in school, don't do drugs.
You got three of my four. So one, take whatever opportunities you can to get way outside your comfort zone. You will see how the world works in ways in which you just never expected and anticipated. And I have a much greater appreciation for people, humanity, community than you otherwise would. And two, Matt, one of the great, great traits that I never credited enough, you know, one of the reasons why I studied engineering in school was because I figured you needed to know how math worked. And I love math because you could get the right answer, and then I couldn't get the right answer. I stopped liking math, right? The analytical skills to be able to understand data and science, and obviously how important that is. But man, what gets lost in that is the ability to tell a story, right? And not to say make one up, but the ability to string a narrative, to be able to put facts and data in context, to explain circumstances and situations to people in a way in which they will resonate and understand. You know, one big thing that I point to in a lot of policy life is the difference between diagnosing and treatment, right? It is one thing to get a bunch of smart people in a room and try to say, hey, tell me what's wrong with this person, community, organization, et cetera. And you get enough smart people in a room and they will tell you that, and they're probably right. It is an entirely different skill set to get a community, organization, country to understand that diagnosis and to take the collective steps to address it. And you're not going to do that without a narrative or a story. And so being able to tell, to spend time, enough time with people to understand how it is that they need to hear things that is going to resonate with them, not alienate them, but bring them along as a skill I wish I had spent more time acquiring and honing, hence C.S. Lewis.
Wow. I've heard you speak a couple of times, and I'd say you're doing all right.
Well, thank you. Means a lot more from you, my friend.
Thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it. And genuinely, you know, this is not just a random platitude at the end of a conversation. Like, genuinely, thank you so much for the elbow grease that you've put into your role as special envoy to North Ireland. Genuinely, I've seen you in action, and sometimes I just think, what does that boy run on? Because he's working hard, that guy. So I appreciate it. I appreciate the sacrifice that you've made, that your family's made. And when I say your family, I mean specifically your wife and your kids coming over and all that sort of stuff. So thank you. And I really enjoyed today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's a great place. The people are extraordinary. It's been a ton of fun, and I've been so fortunate to be able to explore a bit of a really special part of the world. So thanks for having me, and I look forward to seeing you over there in a couple weeks.
Man, you killed that. That was awesome.
No, please, thank you.
Amazing stuff. Just want to give one final thanks to NI Connections for making today's episode possible. You can sign up for their free email newsletter at niconnections.com, where you'll get straight to your inbox interesting stories from people who are from this place but are living and working overseas. You'll also get some really interesting insider information about best practices of how to move back home or how to start a business here and all this other really, really interesting stuff. NIconnections.com is the place to do that. And we're so, so grateful that we're able to keep this series going thanks to NI Connections support. Have a great rest of your day. And thank you so much for checking out the podcast. Cheers.